Hello, animation fans, and welcome to another iAnimate podcast. I'm your host, Larry Vasquez, and you're listening to episode 102. In this episode, we interview Chris Wall, who is the CEO and executive producer over at The Shining Isle, on a project that I've got to work on for the last year and a half or so, the Wing Feather Saga. You may remember me talking a little bit about that in one of our previous podcasts with my lead, Ron Smith. But it was really cool to be able to get Chris in on this podcast, talking to him from his production standpoint and looking at the animation as a whole in regards to projects like we've been able to do here, feature film, things of that nature. And so it was just a great opportunity to get him in on this podcast, talk to him about his experience having worked at DreamWorks, Big Idea, and now his own studio where he's been able to produce the Wing Feather Saga. So let's check it out. All right. Well, Chris, first of all, I always love to thank my guests here. It's always a neat honor to get guys like you in here who have been in the industry. And you're coming from this from a different kind of perspective than some of our other guests. And I think it's going to bring a unique perspective to our topic here. But just first off, great. And thank you for your time.
Thanks, Larry. Glad to be with you and share some stories here.
Awesome. I typically like to kind of go back a little bit to kind of lead up. So I know you've got a theater background. So I'm assuming that has some play in the animation industry, but what got for you to get into the entertainment business?
Well, as a child of the 80s, I grew up with VHS cassettes of my favorite movies. And I have always had an affinity. I grew up with Looney Tunes as my primary discipling tool in entertainment.
That's wonderful.
Which is interesting now looking back, because it was so informed by the music, the voice performance, and then the animation, right? But the undergirding, like really valuing those underpinnings of the quality of the craft of those things, right? Don't throw away on them. And then, you know, the feature renaissance of Little Mermaid, Aladdin, and Lion King, that era, really kind of latched me into loving feature animation. But in college, studied theater and film, kind of a mix. Acted a fair amount on the stage, so I loved the performance side. And then out of school, was working in commercial and kind of short form live action stuff. And at that studio, had an animated project that showed up. Someone brought it to the studio. Hey, we could build out this thing. And it was this thing called You Are Special. It's a Max Lucado short story. He'd written some children's books. He's mostly known as kind of a theologian and a bit of a pastor or whatever. But he'd written some children's stories. And this is one of those that was right as mocap was just coming to the market. And so it was like, hey, there's this company I was with had done some theatrical dance stuff. And so they had a lot of performers. And they're like, hey, you've got performers. We could set up some dots and cameras, and we could film the performers, and then we could mocap this direct-to-video special for cheaper than everybody else, right? And mocap circa 99 to 2000, not good. It literally would have been cheaper to keyframe it, because by the time we clean up all the data, like the animators were like, I'm spending time cleaning up mocap data that I'm honestly not going to use. This is so jittery, you know, it's just like the worst. And so I was editor on that. I got roped into it as an editor, and then was scratching the voice performance of the lead character as we were working on it. And ultimately, they were like, man, you're doing a killer job. Can you stay as that character? And I was like, oh, fantastic. So got to direct one of the sequences in it, you know, so really got a solid taste of animation working in it, right? Not just being a fan of it. And I fell in love with the kind of slow and patient work that is animation. Mm. You really get to come to the best version of that idea over time. You know that in live action, of course, it's the moment the camera's rolling. Do you have it? You know, can you get it in the next 10 seconds? And you may or may not, you know, and or can you, as a director, can you get it in the next, as your shooting day is concluding, or your week or your month or whatever, if there's an of the moment performance that the iteration cycle, and you've heard this from so many animation professionals, but having had a taste of the live action side coming into the animated side, like, oh, you get to be a little more patient and sleep on it and come back to it.
Yeah.
The right choice or not, and get to the best version of it. That producer for that You Are Special piece went on to be a Big Idea. And so I got recruited to VeggieTales in 2004 as they were moving from Chicago to Nashville,
Gotcha.
and started there again, editing primarily.
So when you say editing, you're editing the video clips and putting them together as that the producer part that you, because I'm not ex quite familiar with the role of a producer. Can you explain
Yeah,
that
so
to
I
us?
started off just in the editing seat only,
Okay.
just editing animatics, and then ultimately editing Final Picture. So I got to be on both for that piece.
Gotcha.
And then the same with Veggies, was hired to, and so I did, the first VeggieTales was the Minnesota Cuke, their Indiana Jones kind of spoof.
Okay.
I edited that with Tim Hodge. And then a couple years in that process, started being asked, hey, would you consider producing? We think you have the thing. And I was like, oh, I don't want to be a producer. My brain for producing was like, these are the guys who run the numbers and are like the business executives.
Gotcha.
And I didn't really understand the real creative role that a producer is, right? Which is someone who understands the creative work, and the disciplines, and can pull that team together and to get them to create great products, right? And I'd kind of excluded myself because of the business acumen that I thought I would necessarily need to have, and found that, oh, instead, actually, I'd done enough of the different skills. I had worked as a cinematographer, editor, of course, performer, to understand the craft across a couple of disciplines to know how to help someone achieve their goals, right? And I think that version of a producer is a coach, right? Who's able to say, all right, I've established the playground, I've established the resources, I've recruited the team, let's go have
Gotcha.
fun together. How can I resource you to achieve whatever that artist task is, the best outcome to whatever schedule and budget is necessary, for that project. And that really came to life, in a big idea. I stepped up then as head of studio, in 06, and was there through 2015, making those movies and pulling those teams together. And I found that producing really was the place that I loved. I will say, though, I love the editing chair. I think anybody who starts off, whatever that is, they start off writing, start off whatever that place is, they go back to it. So last night I was up till like 2 in the morning editing. I just love editing, and there was a bit of editing that needed to happen with our show, and I was like, hey, let me jump in there and get into it, and it's really satisfying.
Is it the getting to get the pacing correct and the transitions to fill? I guess pacing for me would be where the editing kind of comes into to play the biggest. Okay.
It's the whole recipe too, because it's, we're kind of in the late stages of this production, so it's more about the finishing elements of, how long certain dissolves are, and how we're supporting that with the sound transition, just kind of the final touches of how a thing is actually working. So, but yeah, on the front end, I also love that. Like for me, starting in radio edit, I love the writer's room, and scripting is great. I love that process. But getting into the first radio edit, right, where you've got your audio, your scratch performance, whatever that is, that's setting the bed for what that experience is going to be, actually something that I love. We have great editors who do that, but it's a task that I, given the option, I would hop back in.
Well, what's cool about from what I'm hearing your experience though, you've got a large or a broad hands-on of the whole production pipeline, you know, as you're kind of mentioning there, dealing with the different disciplines, maybe not particularly touching them, but having a great understanding in how they work. And I think that's very important when it comes to a producer in your position, because the expectation then on what we can accomplish, again, talking about what you said in budget, is very, very important.
Well, and as an animator, if I am just the Princess Bride character of move the thing and the other thing, and become this domineering presence, right? Of like, and you just look back at me going, you don't understand my craft at all, kid.
Right.
Right? One of two ways: either I've given you way too much freedom, and you're like, now I don't even know how to make a decision,
Right.
or tighten the screws so tight that it's impossible to play,
Right.
right? Hopefully, we have to have the freedom to play. And knowing what are the boundaries for my playtime, right? So I can accomplish this, whatever that is. If I'm drawing, if I'm animating, if I'm sculpting, if I'm rigging, like it's at some level it's play, right?
Right.
And am I given the right boundaries so I can play freely and not feel the boundaries every moment, right?
Yeah.
And we all had the bad producer experience, which is they're at the whip and it's just kind of on you, and you're like, I can't really bring life to this in the culture that's being created, right?
Right.
And then the open end of, I don't know what I want, but I got a lot of money, so let's just keep playing. And like, okay. Oh my gosh, that's probably worse.
Right. And that's kind of why I brought that up too. I haven't worked in VFX, but I know that industry can kind of be multi-layered. And I think as a result, kind of come across that. My brother had worked on a show, which is VFX. And it was like, you work on a shot for months and months, and then you give reiteration and that goes up the chain, and you even to polish so that way the executives and stuff can kind of see it more fleshed out. And it may not even be, you know, it's going to come back down the pipeline to go, yeah, let's start this over here. And you're just like, I just spent all this time. We could have been way more efficient on this. And I just, that's what I kind of feel like having worked with you on the Wing Feather Saga, is that you knew what the confines were and how to really then bring out the best in the artists.
It is. And I love when I set up a project, what I've learned about myself is I want to know the constraints early. People have asked that question, like in season one of Wing Feather, how did we know it was going to be 6 episodes? Basic math. And it was competitive projects at this kind of action animated. So Dragon Prince was one of those that we looked at, or Trollhunters even, was, okay, here's the constraints of what they were working within. And we want to have a competitive project to that. The crowdfunding mechanism that we were using, right, from the SEC said we could only raise $5 million, right? Which was like, could we raise $5 million? That'd be incredible. We did in 20 days. Like, it just blew my mind. Okay, so if we raise $5 million, the price per minute, knowing we'd have to set up the process and Keith has to help craft the pipeline, we're going to use Unreal Engine, of course. We're going to need this. Okay, that's probably going to turn into 6 episodes. Okay, so 6 episodes, how would I take that first book of the fantasy series into 6 half-hour episodes? Okay, well, I would probably do this, then this. That's the mid-season one. And then the finale, I want my final image to be this. Okay, now back into then who are the characters that populate those episodes? So you kind of like, so I like backing into it. So then I'm not, if I do the opposite, if I build up into it, oh, I love this character. I love this moment. I love this moment. Blah, blah, blah. I can create a monster that won't fit in the box.
Right.
And then I get like a multi-headed monster that I've cut off a couple heads, and that's the final product, and nobody can make sense of it. Mm-hmm. Right. I'd rather have a completed, well crafted, but smaller than a bigger that won't fit in the box and feels bastardized. Right. Because it got all backed up. So for me, it's that sense of completion, whatever that is. Right. Whether it's a child's crayon drawing that is too big for the piece of paper, right? Like, oh, I should have started with a smaller drawing. Or
yeah. Like one arm's already big, and then I got this much left of the paper.
So paper behind it, you can add on to it. You know, I got the sword. Oh, the sword's so big. Like I like lay out my, give me my scope and let's walk into that. That's my preferential way of kind of, which is, I suppose, fairly like logic and a bit cold maybe. But it's the way that I can define, now I can play. Mm-hmm. Now we can have full freedom.
Yeah.
So the writer's room, go nuts. Here's the parameter. Let's go for it.
Right.
And then as we go into storyboards, like, all right, we're going to be a story driven show. So what do we find on the boards? Yes, we've got scripts, but let's find some moments. You got to sell it. I don't care how wonderful the script is. If it isn't in the boards, it's not anywhere. And then animation. All right, Ron, team, Larry, what can you guys bring to really take this to the next level? And here's your freedom. Here's your boundary. Don't go completely wild, right? Because I'm gonna nip and tuck you to death. You know, here's your boundary of that's what we're trying to accomplish. Here's the emotional tone we're trying to hit. And then okay, now visuals. Now go into the art department and what are we gonna bring to that? You know, go nuts. Like here's the reference points and bring it to life. So each area getting the additive flourish is the kind of project that I love.
Right.
I want each one to feel the liberty to just keep plussing, finding ways to plus. I will say there's a structural thing, Larry, that I have become aware of. The animation industry is not incentivized to accomplish this way outside of singular studios.
Okay.
Every time I've outsourced, so I did 16 movies with VeggieTales. Every time I've outsourced, I'm immediately in a contractual obligation at odds with the artist. Right. So I've got dollars that I've assigned to a production, whether it's in Toronto or Singapore, New Zealand, I don't care where I've set up. On the other side of that is a person trying to make the most out of the profit that I've offered to them by minimizing the time and energy expended into the project, which is at odds with perhaps artistic achievement.
Right.
So with Wingfeather, we obviously went the other way. We went the other way of hiring directly because of Unreal Engine, right? Because the pipeline was going to be so weird. We're like, there's no studio we could outsource to. Who would even, nobody's going to build this, right?
Gotcha.
We said, but what we found is instead, I'm directly working with these artists and my tension is internal, like it is at large studios. But with TV shows, that's not common, right? I mean, there are some, but most are in some way at odds in a check and balance kind of way with someone trying to make this for the cheapest amount they can. And meaning too cheap sometimes, right? And
Right,
so
right.
it doesn't have the freedom to think additively because they have to think execution, right? They can only think close this out, hit my number of seconds, hit my rigging, hit my whatever that measurement is. And so you're actually creating art against widgets of numbers rather than artistic breakthrough. Now the feature film, which has no limits, frustrating.
Right.
So we had a number of all company meetings at DreamWorks where Jeffrey Katzenberg was like, I'm losing my mind. We can pay the same dollars at the theater to see an epic franchise like Kung Fu Panda or How to Train Your Dragon or Peabody and Sherman. And the audiences are paying any different, but we have to budget differently. And it was at the time he was really frustrated that Peabody and Sherman had become so expensive. Because of revision, he's like, it cannot cost anywhere near. And it was also because Chris was across the street at Illumination beating the crap out of everybody with Despicable at $80 million, right? And he was like, we're spending $150 million on this thing to track, and so the iterative side of feature can also torpedo, and kind of
Right.
mess with things.
Yeah.
So the freedom can go a little sideways. You gotta, there's a constraint side, and I think that's what was life about Wingfeather Saga in both season one and two has been creating the boundaries to allow the artist to explore, me guiding as showrunner to be efficient in choices, because if I'm recalcitrant, I like this. No, I don't like this. I want that. No, try this. Like I've learned, I've been long enough in the industry to know that like that's where you dither away all your good energy to find.
Absolutely. Yeah.
It's better to have, in my opinion, it's better to have, and this is I get probably contested, but my opinion, it is better to have an idea that's 80% great and 100% executed well than it is to stretch for that 90 or 100% great and have it half-baked at 60% execution.
Right.
That's my opinion. I think that the strain of that last bit of craft, the cost is so astronomically high. And the return is often, it doesn't get fully finished. I
Gotcha.
would rather fully finish an idea that's 80% there than to not. So like I just had a note last night from one of our editors. Hey, I was just watching this one scene with these two kids at the table in the fork factory. And the camera is crossing a line pretty badly in the camera coverage, which is a big bugaboo of mine. That endures. And I said, I see it, and you're not wrong. It's definitely, but in the overall audience experience, that's definitely an 80%. Like we didn't hit our marks on that, but I'd rather take our energy towards making this other moment fully succeed.
Right.
And that's a I don't love that, and for the editors, for the craftsmen of that department, it's like, hey, you're embarrassing me. And so they'll go drill down and fix it, and you're like, well. That's ILM at that point, right? Because ILM is king of this, right? Driving to pixel perfection doesn't mean that it has a soul, but it's pixel perfect,
It's
right?
perfect. Yeah.
And I'm like, no, we're not pixel perfecting. Like they're our fault. You can totally go, you should go watch our show and find all our faults. Oh, that's a penetration. We had that early on releasing the show. Like, I saw a smooth penetration on Poto. You damn straight you did. And you're gonna see a lot more of it. Because it just is like if that's throwing you out of the movie, the people hate your story, they hate your characters.
Right.
I've never sat next to a 10-year-old or 11-year-old who was like, I saw a penetration on Poto. Do you like the pirate?
Kind of reminds me of one of my favorite shows growing up was Transformers, right? The 80s cartoon, right? Well, my
What do you
brother,
think about the new movie? I realize you're like, I'm totally split on it.
I haven't seen enough of it yet. I did
Yeah.
like Bumblebee, though.
The characterizations are really fun, but me and my kids watch my teenagers and they couldn't make sense of it. They're like, I don't know what this wants to be.
Okay.
It wants to be a TV show or is it a feature? Because it feels
Okay.
like a feature, but its rendering feels like TV. But It was weird. I watched them watch it and then going, I don't know what to make of this. Now I have the affinity of the 80s cartoon in my head.
Okay, so that kind of goes back to my point here. As a kid, you're just enthralled with the story, the characters and stuff.
Yeah, right.
But my brother was like, hey, Larry, don't go back now and watch it. I'm like, why is that? He's like, it'll destroy it in your mind. Because in your mind, the transformations, everything was just off, because you're so enthralled with the story and the characters, right? And that kind of goes back a little bit. Now, ours isn't like that. Ours is very nice and solid. You're going to find penetrations on foots and things like that. But you should be so enthralled with the characters and the story and the music and the lighting and everything that's there that you go, hey, that's nothing, you know?
It's kind of a live theater approach. And I guess probably my theater background, now that you say that,
okay,
probably ties into this, which my wife directs our high school theater program. And so I'm constantly getting to see these. I'm going this evening to another theatrical production of You Can't Take It With You, the old Frank Capra movie. and it's just so much baling wire and duct tape everywhere. Because that's theater, right?
Right,
it's
right.
All just, it works right here, just in front. Nope, don't look over here. Don't step aside because it falls apart. So that was the coolest thing in the credits for season two, that we did this like show you, here's the image you see.
Right.
You know, Klaus had done this. I loved it. And it's the old Disney multiplane thing. And then turn the camera and realize, haha, trick. Like, it's not real. It's
yeah.
All just like flats. Haha. It's like, what does it take to communicate emotionally with the audience? Can you travel around our set and walk? No, you can't. It's a bunch of flats. But if I've told you the story well enough, then that's all I need. I'm not going to sit here and pixel polish and get enamored with the technical craft and forget that my job is to entertain the audience.
Right.
Go with that 10-year-old and like, am I delivering to them what they love?
Right.
Hey, like if that's what I'm doing, we're winning.
Right. Don't get
distracted. And I think that's from our company, that's method across all our methodology. That we literally have laptops and folding tables in a lot of cases, because it's like, yeah, I could get the super nice desk and I could get the super nice setup, but and ergonomically make sure it works for you. I don't want to hurt your body, but also like, if you need a hatchet, why am I giving you a chainsaw?
Right.
Like the chainsaw is super sexy and it's awesome, but if you need a hatchet to accomplish it, get the right tool and just love that and do good work with it.
Yeah.
I think so often in our industry of the world of wonderful world of animation, we get enamored with tool sets too often in the technical outsets and the audience doesn't care. Like they don't want that. And that was, so much of what Wing Feather was birthed out of was like, hey, let's chase the story. Let's chase the craft of animation.
Yeah.
In its most interesting forms and not keep chasing pixels. And again, I go back to Transformers because I recognize that with that new movie that they're having to find a distinguishing mark between them and the VFX live action version, because they're so close together. Right? Like the Transformers movies of before, like where does it become an animated movie? Right. Yeah. This now. And so I don't want to play that tension at all.
Right. Right.
I want to go back. Like I love the basics of our industry. Like take a drawing and make it come to life, take a lamp and make it hop around and come to life. Like the imbuing of life into an inanimate object.
Right.
I believe it's a creator given task that each of us is wired with from our creator. And we get to take our own life and imbue it into another thing. And it is an amazing process. Mm-hmm. So does it have to be pixel accurate? No. Does it have to communicate and create emotional pathos? Yeah. That's what we want to
get. That's what it's about. If we really believe the story is king, right?
Yeah. Well, and this is the guy that worked on VeggieTales, no arms, no legs, right? We got to act with it. So I recognize that I'm what I'm talking about when I
yeah.
But it's like, take that limitation and say, can you do it? Ron Smith, can you, because he was with Veggies back in the day, can you get a cucumber to shrug? Figure it out, man. I don't know. Like, that's fun. Like, so my first entertainment experience was, I was probably 8 or 9, and I had my best friend at the time. She loved puppets and I loved puppets, and we would do puppet shows. And we'd write, I found the scripts actually recently. My parents were unearthing some
stuff. Oh, that's awesome.
Written scripts, and we would do these puppet shows for our families, and it was the basics of what Jim Henson was lighting our brains up in the 80s, right? Like what you could do with a simple sock puppet, adhere to that base and then figure out how do computers come into this, and don't leave the joy of that simplicity as you create.
Love it. And that was really kind of going back to that sandbox analogy that you had there was A lot of freedom I felt like with as an animator, and I think the freedom came from knowing what our constraints were. And that seems kind of almost a paradoxical, but you go, it makes sense because I go, I'm not too confined, and I also don't go, well, what happens if I go way over there? Because I still have the timeline here. I've still got to get a certain amount of, footage done in a time. And that knowing where my constraints were at, it made me be able to go, okay, I can play within here. Let me manage my time well, and it felt like that was kind of across the board with all of the animators. It seemed like
It
we're
is, and
able
it's
to
the kind
get
of
out
people
the
that we
best.
recruit and hire, because I think the other side of that, Larry, is you hire people who just hang on the fence and pine for other freedoms. And those aren't the people you want on the job, right? Because you certainly get the people leaning against the fence, man, well, they got a bigger budget over there, or I could accomplish this. If I had more time, I could really get that Oscar I've always wanted, right? And like, you're not our people. Our people are like, here's my playground. Let me get clever. Keith always uses this illustration. Apollo 13, middle of the movie. Throw a bunch of stuff on a table. All right, with everything that's on this table, how do we get those astronauts home? Solve it. Yeah, but I need a torch. There's no torch here. Well, I'm gonna need this. It's not on the table. Like, what's on the table? Get creative. And I think when we can engage the creative spark, right? And that we I can like so when you're here's my scene assignment, animate, create this moment with these characters, this set, this background, whatever. Go. And if you go, well, I don't have what I need. Well, thank you, auteur. Have fun over in your career. You're not for us, right? If you're like, oh, I love to create. Give me some. We got some. Ooh, see some hot glue right here, and oh, some sparkles. Like, that's why I think that theater background in me is probably, and especially watching my wife in high school theater, just pulling that stuff out of nowhere. It's like we went to Czech Republic, to visit our friends from Animalia when we first launched Wingfeather. And we were staying at this castle in Český Krumlov, and it's one of these really old castles that has one of these crazy old theaters that never burned. So much of those old theaters and castles of the era, in some war-torn era, but this one is preserved. And you step in, and it's this beautiful proscenium from the king and queen's box, whatever. And there's these, it looks like Grecian pillars all the way through, and then there's this beautiful forested stage. And you're like, wow, this is so amazing! And you walk down there. And all these granite and marble pillars are all just fake flats. They're with muslin on it, and there's no, it's all fake, completely fake. It's a bit of candle lighting, and the walls are actually fabric. They're not even plaster walls. They look like everything's fake, and it's like that's kind of awesome.
But it worked.
So it's not that we've been doing this in entertainment our whole lives, right? And it's just embracing that, right?
Now, kind of going back to the look and the style, how quickly in the production for Wingfeather was that established? So,
So
sorry, real quick, you spent time at DreamWorks for about almost 3 years. You were a freelance producer for almost 9, and then The Shining Isle, which is the company that heads up the Wingfeather saga, that's been going on for about 8 years. So, this being your first project here as the CEO and executive producer at The Shining Isle, how quickly did the established look for this project come into play?
Well, in those intervening years, so from 2012 to 15, the 3 years with DreamWorks particularly was when they were starting TV. Now, I was with VeggieTales up through the feature side. So we just kind of observed the TV side. And then a portion of crew went over, not, myself, to make the VeggieTales TV show within that. And what I observed is in TV was most often the cheaper version of feature, right? And so it looks cheaper. This was also the era. In those 20 teens, whatever, of a lot of these $10 to $20 million animated features coming to market that were trying to be sold as Pixar level animation. And of course, they just weren't. And nobody's believing that's a Kia. You can't tell me that's a Mercedes. That's a Kia. Just call it what it is. And that cheaper version, we all know what it takes to achieve Zootopia, right? To achieve those big features. It's an enormous amount of artistic and monetary input to achieve it. So don't fake it. Like, there's no magic bullet. I get so tired in this industry of whether it's financiers or executives coming in, we've got the magic bullet. So in my experience, of course, it was you are special with mocap, in 1999. Like, no, it's not real yet. And then Zemeckis did his stuff. And so then everybody's trying to crack it and like not have to pay for animators, essentially, right? and pay for the craft. Like, how can I bypass actors? Right? It's like, how can you bypass art to sell art?
Right. You're in entertainment, right?
However, how can you make it the right budget for the constraints? So we stepped into Winged Feather and creating Shining Isle with this intent. And so I had done a short project, a Peanuts test, actually, with Keith Lengo, that was testing the same thing. Like, what could we do if you were going to try to bring Charles Schulz Peanuts to life? They had reached out. This is before they did the feature with Blue Sky. We're going to do a project with them at Big Idea. And we did this little short test, which I can send it to you. I don't know if you've seen it before, but it's awesome. It's everything that we did with Winged Feather in its very infancy, like as far as edge breakup and oscillating textures and
very cool.
All that. We were testing it even back then, which would have been 2009, I think, maybe 2008.
Wow.
So reaching out to Keith and saying, hey, how can we crack this? Because I don't want the cheap version of a feature, because we thought about Winged Feather as maybe a series of features, maybe a TV series, but we don't want the cheap version. I want it to be artistically satisfying with a certain level of craft, much like you see out of, you know, Miyazaki, right? It's in 2D, but American audiences really want CG, but CG is photoreal, or so we've learned. And so how do we break that? And Keith was like, well, I think that CG got set on that path, but I don't think it is meant to live there. The photoreal is the only outcome. I think non-photoreal within CG is actually an interesting path. Great, let's explore. And so that began that journey of testing out, which ultimately led to doing this Kickstarter. It's kind of one of our first ventures with the company to say, let's go prove out in a short film what we're talking about. And that was released then in 17. We had a very successful Kickstarter in 2016. And then in 17, released the short film. And it was kind of a test of the story device for the book reader to say, do you like this version of the story and animation? And then for the craft, could we make it with this style, philosophical style, that would take a certain budget price point and achieve a craft, a certain, right? That was the real stress test. Could we do something interesting and new and different? So we showed that short everywhere. And it was really funny because from Netflix to Paramount, and we actually went and saw Murray. You know, she had done all the Madagascar series at DreamWorks, and she was at Paramount at the time. And so went and saw her, and she was like, oh, guys, this is amazing. But we're wanting the Pixar thing, you know, which is interesting because we actually screened the entire short in her office. And then to watch Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, literally using our recipe, I was like, okay, you really liked it, actually. That's great. I love it. But thankfully, Spider-Verse came out, and everybody said, okay, maybe we are tired of the Pixar look.
Right,
maybe
right.
Something new to be done. And so we found that we were in the right zone. That short also proved that the production pipeline was going to be a little too unwieldy. We did it all in Maya from a lighting and rendering perspective. And Keith, you know, like Game Engine stuff, was like, hey, I've been noodling around in UE. I think I can port all of our tech into all of our shader systems into UE. And we did. And then the show went on in UE. And of course, to infamy, because we were able to accomplish way more, literally turning off entire sections of our production. You know, we don't have compositing at all. We don't do lighting as a separate pass. It's coloring in UE. But everything is in UE at the finish, and we just file export a movie, and that goes to editorial. And it's an astonishing, like when you think about the wins, we solved it by trimming out a technological expense, not an artistic. So we still spent the same for the artists. Now we animate on twos. So there's some savings there, of course. It wasn't chipping away at the artistic input. It's like save the dollars, keep those guys doing their great work of discovering creating beautiful art. Let's see if we can cut the technology side to make that easier. I think so many enterprises go, let's cut the artists and make it cheaper there and let technology win. I'm like, I think it's better to see if you can make technology become smaller, right? And let humans win.
Right.
Let the artists have more to flourish with. And that really became what ultimately became the animated series through that journey.
Gotcha. When you mentioned animating on twos, I actually really, really liked animating on twos.
Do you? Good.
Oh, wonderful. And I think part of it is the look too. Yeah. I think you still get the fluidity in animation, but there's a, for lack of a better term, a roughness still that kind of gives it a feel of an art form. It doesn't look, it gives it that tactile feel, I guess,
sure.
But still that organic smoothness too. So it's kind of a nice combination.
Yeah, and it's all about Keith uses this term cohesive abstractism,
Okay.
right? And it's about moving something to abstract. How far do you move to abstract, right? So in Miyazaki experiences, it's quite abstract. In Zootopia, not to pick at it, but the pixels are right there. It's kind of right there. Like my imagination is not taxed whatsoever. Miyazaki, my imagination is firing off like all over the place. He wanted to be more in that space where we deliver a level of abstractism that allows the audience to pop in with their imagination to fill in the ones, because we're on twos, right? To fill in and to drive hard on emotional intent, to make clear choices so that they know where the characters are going. I think some of the reason we do the more finite stuff is to really get at the emotional expressionism. And I think that there's ways that 2D does this beautifully. And so we aimed more that direction of like, let's just have good posing, and fast rigs that we can try things and iterate a bit and find the best version of it. But it let us have more iterations rather than driving it down to a more finite. Also, frankly, if we're doing an abstract environment, right? So the final image is so abstract with hand-painted backgrounds and all this. If I move my emotion and finesse on ones, my brain kind of breaks because I've given you a visual that says abstract, but then I've given you movement that says non-abstract. And they fight against each other, right? So your movement has to feel abstract. And now, for those that watch Wing Feather Saga, I just last night, Larry, watched episode one from season one again. And it's rougher than we do now. We were really trying to find it. We were like, what, how limited could we be in keyframes? And it's got some bumps in it that I Keith and I joked about going back and like retooling that first episode. Because even as season one progresses, people have so responded to season two. I'm like, oh my gosh, you guys, season two is incredible. Like, to be honest, season one's incredible. Because if you watch from episode one through six, it dramatically, we found our
Yeah,
recipe,
100%. I
right?
came in on episode three of season two of season one.
Yeah, so
So
we were
I,
kind of already settled in.
and even at that point, it was kind of like, oh, did we kind of do it on twos? Yeah, and by then, we had really kind of established that it was on twos.
And that gave everybody confidence. The variable thing, which we were trying to, we'd done that in the short film, and then Spider-Verse does that quite a bit. They have a variable frame. And it just proved to be, you call it right at the right times and the wrong at the wrong times. And it was like, bah, it's like, just stay on twos and everybody's fine. We actually now figured out in season two, Larry, I don't know if you know this, but on the render side, we do render, we'll basically render at 12 FPS mostly. But we will kick it up to 18 frames for like fast motion. So episode one, Pete is battling the Rockroach, this giant monster. The movements are quite swift, and on twos, it just becomes kind of staccato, and there's not enough information. So we crank those up, or we do it at 18, so it's not full ones because ones doesn't work, but it's like in between, and it feels great. It's like
And has that been pretty easy to do within like something on Unreal?
Unreal Engine. Thank you very much. It does those interpolations, no problem, man. It's cool. That part's been awesome.
How quickly were you bringing Keith in on the project?
Day one.
Okay.
Yeah, he was co-founder. I mean, he was like, yeah, we don't go forward unless we figure this out.
Did you have a working experience with him prior, or did you know him
Yeah,
about
so
him, like, hey, I got to reach out to this
he had
guy
been,
here?
we crossed paths at Big Idea. He had been on
That's
a day with
right.
Details, and
Yes,
then he had
yes.
done 3-2-1 Penguins with Ron. So they were old pals. He was actually living in Tennessee for a while, and I was introduced to him after we'd moved here. And I had hired him to help us with we had a tool called VeggieTales in a Box. That was basically a deployment tool that we could send it to an outsource studio that would give them all the tool sets to make Bob, Larry, and the rest of the VeggieTales team animate. So it had pose panels and animation instruction that Keith had provided. This is when he was doing his online animation school as well. So we got to know each other through that. And then, like I said, around 2007 or 8, we hired him in on contract to help make this pitch for Peanuts. And really had a great time together, just kind of. And so we just had different projects. We'd kick back and forth on the side, want to try this, want to try this. And then ultimately, Wing Feather became the one that we, with Shining Isle kind of dove in on.
Well, it was been a treat to work with both him and Ron as well, just with their experience too. Kind of going back to some of the stuff you've talked about here, and I think in one of the dailies, he brought up an example from Blue Sky on Ice Age, where I think the two squirrels are dancing.
Okay. Yeah.
And I forget what who the animator was, but he spent like about a month on the shot. He goes, by the time you realize and watch it, so much it's at nighttime, so much is in dark in the shadows. He goes, you hardly see, so it's that kind of stuff. He's like, kind of going back to what you're talking about. Let's put the emphasis on what's going to actually be seen. And it just, again, it becomes efficient. And it's not so much always that you're cutting. I can now use that time somewhere else, right?
It is portioning the time. It's not a loss of energy. It's saying, great, hey, you've got some free cycles. Go punch this shot up or go make this better or go
Right.
tackle this new footage and give us that iteration where we can look back across an entire episode and go, like, this is working. This one scene, if we could plus it, the whole thing would just really sing, you
Right,
know?
right. And one of the other things, I think I mentioned this in the podcast with Ron, I love that we did on this show was having shots in sequence. That was a huge, I felt like a time saver for the animator, as well as I felt like I owned it a little bit more. I felt like I kind of became more of a director in that sense because I could see the flow of how it was going. How quickly was that kind of implemented in regards to the thought
So that,
process?
yeah, thanks to Keith being, you know, he's from the seat of the animator. You know, he was like, hey, I want to do this way. And that's a scheduling nightmare, and there's efficiency questions, and I know why other studios don't do it that way. When you're on TV, especially. Certainly feature will mess with it that way. Man, it just brings a cohesion to your point of like you can see the thought process through. I had done a one of my first producing gigs was producing 3-2-1 Penguins. It's another TV series that we did for NBC at Big Idea. And we produced it with can't remember the name, Indian studio, brilliant, really talented. And they had like 50 animators. Like it was just a so and you know the day for night business where you work during the day and then they work their day and that
Right.
makes you get a bunch of footage. The footage just came flying across and you know, English second language. So we were having to do, you know, face sheets and you know, all the lip reads and all this. It was arduous. And each animator was doing shots, right? And so the characterization would shift from shot. It's really tough, man. You're like, there's the character. Nope, he's gone again. Nope, off him again. You know, and they'd go, well, the dope sheets aren't right. We're like, well, yeah, but you like six animators did 1 second of footage. Anyways, so that we just knew we didn't want to do that, the slice and dicing, because it doesn't stitch back together well. We were more about holistic, which you know became problematic because each scene is like all scenes are not created equal.
Right.
You know, Larry's like, oh, I finished my scene. Yeah, you had one character, and the other guy, I finished my scene, and had like six characters.
100%,
Oh, I'm
yeah.
sorry, you know. But it did work, and I love that about our show because you do get a consistency across a given scene that you can feel the artistic intent, you know.
Right.
And I will say to Ron's credit, I just think this is really important, is that he had started off his career with VeggieTales, directed 3-2-1 Penguins, and so knew how to be scrappy, but then had spent, you know, the bulk of his career now in large studios.
Blue Sky
And when
and
we
Disney.
hired him, we were like, I mean, Keith and I were open about it. Is it going to work? Because the studio guy just may not know how to get scrappy again. Because
Gotcha.
it's going to change methodology and fit to this pipeline, right? And can't pine away for, well, I wish I had more. You don't. This is what we have. You know, can you make it work with the resources we have? And to Ron's credit, man, did he find it. And just really like and not in a resistive way. He was like all in, like, I'm going to figure this out,
Yeah,
you know.
yeah, yeah.
The same with our art director, Garrett Taylor, you know, comes from 10 years at Pixar. I just finished Lightyear, you know, in art directing. And so he, you know, we're like, I don't know how this guy's going to work. You know, so welcome to TV land and
Yeah.
folding table, you
Your
know.
budget's not the same, buddy. Yeah.
No, and letting them find their feet inside the series and bring craft to a different sandbox, right?
Yeah.
Just amazing.
Do you think the story, the characters had an involvement in regards to getting scrappy? I guess the reason why I ask that is because when you take someone like Garrett, who's worked at the highest level, same thing with Ron, when they come in on a story like this and characters that it's really it's okay. My audience, if you've not checked these out, go check them out. It's wonderful, just fun. Epic. It feels, I think that you guys described it one time as Lord of the Rings meets Chronicles of Narnia meets The Princess Bride, you know? And I went, okay, shut up and take my money, you know? I'm all in on this.
Yeah,
totally. It just got so much heart. The music's great. I forgot. Oh, so did you find that guys like Garrett and Ron were able or willing to get more scrappy because of the investment in the product, I guess, versus like it being more sterile? And it's just like, hey, look, you know, this, I gotta do what I gotta
do. One of us that gets to work on a project that an artist is appealing to an artist, is like, as a producer, you hope you can be on those projects.
Yeah.
It's kind of hard to pull people into a project that's irritating, you know, or inane, or just not your thing. You know, we've all done those projects, right? Where it's like, yeah, it's fine. It's not my thing. Right. I think in the happy thing we had is that not whether the book series, people had read these novels and been like, oh my gosh, they're amazing, or just getting into our show and our scripts and our animatics and resonating with the project.
Right.
A lot. And that is a really cool thing, you know, that we get to be a part of. And we're not labor abusers. I think, you know, you have these projects that we love, Spider-Verse, I'm looking at you, who are just like, wow, that's so cool to be a part of. How much did it cost you out of your flesh to accomplish? You know,
yeah.
In our case, like, we work hard, but we try to hold a really healthy balance there so that people can leave going, I still love this project.
Mm-hmm.
There's a bitterness that can set in for anybody, for the producers too. If it's like, I poured too much into and that project hurt me. And then you just don't love your work anymore. And that's a sad, sad turn. I don't ever want us to have to go through.
Right. So,
you know, I think we guide the choices there to make sure that the project stays interesting. Which is delightful, because then when you went to voice casting, right? Because you've made something that's compelling and interesting, your voice cast is like, hook me up,
right?
Like no problem. And it's been the most amazing response from these brilliant actors coming to the project, because they're like, yeah, no, that's awesome. I love it. And we had this sweet note from Henry Ian, who plays Keet. He finally saw the episodes and trailer and was like, oh my gosh, that is so much better. Like, he really liked season one, but season two, he's like, guys, and that's great.
That's
like,
awesome.
Winning on that level where the voice actor is wants to tell other friends, you know, you're making something pretty special.
Yeah. And kind of going back to something you'd said too, that work balance, there were shots that I had where, yeah, it was the same footage and I had multiple characters. And you're like, oh man. But then I felt like there was also a gracious and understanding knowing that. So the schedule was kind of accommodating, for lack of a better term, knowing sure. that then I was going to get another shot here with, you know, a headshot, right? And it was going to be much quicker, right? So yeah, that felt good, where that didn't feel like you're up against the wall here with it, you know?
Yeah. And that's an important balancing out. I think that in some kind of factory versions of animation that some of me have experienced, where, you just don't have that rhythm and release of like, yeah, let me pound through this 6-character walk and talk. That's going to really beat me up. And then give me a 2-person OTS, dirty OTS dialogue scene. Whew, thank you. You know? but it is paying attention to the artist as best we can. And,
yeah.
And I think because we're artist driven people, we get to make those choices, right?
Yeah. And I felt like that being a smaller studio too gave you that more ground level versus just being a number.
Yeah, it was back to the beginning of our conversation. If I'm outsourcing to whatever studio, that's not how it gets prioritized, right?
Right.
It's about how fast can we get out of this and be as profitable as possible.
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with that, I suppose, but it creates a contract, right?
Right, right.
Yeah, I don't know you can ever shake it.
Going back to pacing a little bit, I had someone here recently ask me, why are some of the episodes a little bit different than the books? The books have been very well received. Andrew mm-hmm. Peterson's fantastic author. Just the difference between film and books. I've got my understanding now, which I didn't have, and probably still haven't worked on this here. How would you explain that to somebody?
So I think there's one guiding principle which, you know, Pixar and John Lasseter really championed, which is firsthand experience. That you don't want stories to fall, or any artistic experience, to derivative. Derivatives is like the worst thing possible to any art, where I loved this and I'm going to make a derivative copy of it, is just, yeah. I have a high sensitivity to it. So first and foremost, it's, I love this narrative prose book experience. Great. Now I'm going to go in a completely different format and make the same experience of the story, but different. And I'm looking at it instead of reading it or listening to it from an audiobook. So inherently, I've just crossed over. Embrace what that new space gives you. And then, you know, we talked about this quite a bit, that for me, the concept is, this story exists in a real place. It's a real object in mysterious space that Andrew observed and wrote down in a novel with a certain amount of prose. We are observing the same story, but we have a film camera.
Right.
We're going to capture things in this same overall story in a different vantage.
Yeah.
And we should. I'm going to see things. I'm going to bring things forward that Andrew didn't capture. And I'm also going to not pay attention to some things that he paid attention to.
Mm.
Because it's not in my storytelling device. I don't have all pages of narrative prose to tell you how the character is feeling with such beauty, unless I want to fall to the narrator, which I did not want to do. I want to make the story come alive in that way. So that necessitated a number of changes, because particularly in book one, and it was Andrew's first novel, and so he's very open about this. I'm not telling tales out of school. He's like, hey, I was figuring out how to write novels. By book two, he got a lot better. And by book three and four, he was like in his craft.
Yeah.
Book one had a lot of things happening to the characters by virtue of the storyteller said so. But the story was happening to the characters in a way that they didn't have agency. They weren't making changes in the world. They were kind of tumbling along because the author was making it happen to them. And so we needed to find a way in the animated series to turn that, which meant the most dramatic changes.
Gotcha.
You couldn't say from book one cleanly what is the lead characters want from the book. It's not defined yet. It wasn't defined until books two and three, really. Book one, we had to craft something.
Yeah.
What does it want? And therefore, then what is the little sisters want? What is the moms want? Undefined, largely by the book. And in visual narratives, you have to know what those are, so that you can act it. Otherwise, Larry, you can't animate that character.
Right.
I don't know what they want. I don't know what's my motivation?
What's my motivation? That's
your character, right? Like, I got to act this thing. Give me something.
Right.
And so that took the most work, and that meant reordering some things. It meant, you know, pushing some things around, right? Plussing this up, taking this down, you know, finding ways to make sure the characters were driven by their choices and how it was affecting the world, and being faithful. So, I mean, I think by the time we finished season one, a bunch of our detractors early on settled in, right? They went, okay, you told the same story.
Right.
Early on, it was disorienting, right? There's enough changes. They were like, wait, that's not what happened there. Wait, that's not. And then it started, saw it all settle down, went, okay, season two is different. Season two, we 100% have been able to drive with the plot, right? Because it's in there, you know, so that's been delightful.
Yeah. So one of the things I felt like was really unique on this project, and maybe you can kind of correct me based upon your experience, was that Andrew Peterson, the author, was very much involved in the adaptation of this.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a unique fitment and risky as all get out. Normally, in this kind of thing, a producer would go option the rights, right? Meaning, dear author, may I have the rights to go do this? And they would license you and you'd pay a fee to that person, some arrangement of that. And you'd go make it, and then they'd have some sort of review process. So I like it, I don't like it, so they, usually for the author, but you don't want them in the daily sauce, because they've made a thing that they love and cherish. And when you start moving the furniture around, they go nuts, right? They're like, no, that's not what I wrote, you know? And like, yeah, but what you wrote doesn't work in this format. I don't care. The worst version of this, it's been publicly Stephen King. So that he's been accused of being the book whore, and that he just kind of hands his books to people to adapt for film and really doesn't make sure that they hold to the what he wrote, right? And so, you know, most of his movies are uneven at best, you know, from the books. And then there's the other side where they hold it to jot and tittle, and then you get this derivative piece of art. Right. Everybody says they want, I want what's on the page.
Right.
You don't actually.
No.
It's actually quite bad. You think you want it. So it's like Peter Jackson, one of the most successful adaptations, right, of Lord of the Rings. And people, that's for the books right there. No, it's not. Or read the books. He changed lots of stuff in dialogue, but he maintained the character intent. What right. I had found in reading Wing Feather Saga was it was so whimsical and so interesting in its space. I wasn't sure we could keep that sauce right. And so I said, Andrew, would you partner in forming Shining Isle Productions, and you and I will be executive producers. I am showrunner, so I'm responsible for delivering this thing, but you're right in there and get to say yes or no to things. And let's go make this together. And he was great. I had seen him as a collaborator in other areas of his artistic endeavors and was like, I think this is going to work. And it's been brilliant. And he had strong opinions at times, but he also early on in that experience had strong opinions that were against his own decisions. Famously in the short film, the writers, Kenny and Jake, submitted their script and we were reading through it. And there's this one bit where the lead character Janner is kind of yelling at Poto, his grandfather, and you're not my dad. And it was this weird, like, and Ender's like, oh, these writers, guys, no, that's not my books. They don't say that. And they were like, okay, thank you. Thank you. That's on page 157 of chapter 40. And Ender's like, what? Because in the long view of that character over the four books, like I said, but book one, there's some stuff, right?
Gotcha.
Like little desires and things that just weren't quite on track with the character. And so early on, he got a taste of that and learned, okay, we're in good hands. We're all going to find this together, right? Some of those bits, we're going to just take those out and not use them. You know, and yeah, it's been amazing to keep him in there because it has kept the recipe right. You know,
yeah. Yeah, that was, I guess that was my, I've answered this question now, having been in this situation, is that you're taking a medium, books, that you're solely at the, have words, that's it. That's all I have is words, right? Into a medium that now has lighting, now has dialogue, now has music, now has, you know, camera angles, and it's completely different. And again, also on a much quicker turnaround as far as, like, you know, maybe season one's what, total? Six episodes, less than
half hour each.
Yeah. Whereas a book might be 8, 9, 12 hours, right? So how do I condense that as well into this medium? So the pacing is very much different and you have different tools at your disposal to communicate the same things that a book only has words.
And may I just say, that was one of the things we learned in the short film is that we tried to pack too much into our 15 minutes. We were so wanting to keep all the kids in the basket that we included so much plot detail that it was, for the book reader, it was entertaining because it was like, checking all the boxes.
Yeah.
Everybody outside, it was like, that was a rush of words and ideas and characters that I can't make any sense of.
Right, right.
That was really helpful to do the short film and go, that's too much information too fast.
Gotcha.
Some people have criticized the series as being slower paced, right? And very intentional on our behalf. We want a story you can kind of settle into, really get to know the landscape, get to know the characters, and then begin to build the stakes and pick up the momentum. And gotcha. So we have no problem with, you know, it's interesting. So episode three, as we're talking, is out in the world for season two. And it's a talky episode. It's a lot of talking. And it's been by far the fans' favorite episode. First two episodes are the big action climaxes, big bangers, right? And they loved them, but they didn't know how much they would love this third one, which is, you know, well executed, mind you, by our story department and by the animation department to make a heavy monologue, talky episode just work.
Gotcha.
You don't need devices. It's just good old fireside storytelling. and I'm not afraid of those. I think that there's this fear in the industry of, it's all TikTok, man. I disagree. Dune 2 exists.
Yeah.
Symphony halls still have people coming to them.
Yeah.
Like, deliver on your craft and the audience is there.
Yeah.
Short form kind of madhouse of the TikTok world. It's not satisfying. It's entertaining.
Right.
It's not satisfying. I want to create satisfying entertainment. And that means I'm going to eschew some things, right? I'm not going to fall for those other things. I love the TikTok stuff. And it may be clear, the short form and fast user-paced, great. It should exist in the world. But when I go to really settle in to a story, you know, and I was so bolstered by Andor, you know, the Star Wars, I just so patient in letting a story unfold with no characters that I knew. Like, it's all like, I have all the reason in the world to not want to plug into that story. And I thankfully did. And it just rewarded me so much. So I think Wing Feathers is comfortably in its own skin, right?
Gotcha.
So, yep, we're this kind of story. And you can engage with it. And I hope that it encourages more like us to exist in the world.
Absolutely. Right? Absolutely. A couple more questions for you before we wrap things up. I don't want to hold you up too much. What is your overall vision for The Shining Isle as we continue to move forward? I know, obviously, the Wing Feather Saga has multiple
episodes. Four seasons to go. Yeah. Seven seasons to tell of that story, to finish the four books. We want to create more entertainment of the similar DNA. So kind of raise the tent that says, okay, Wing Feather worked. Similar DNA of entertainment, not necessarily fantasy in the same, but certainly using some of the animation technology that we've developed. We think that there's ways to push and pull that and make more other products. The genre could be whatever. I don't think we're picked on that, but the storytelling device, we think there's an ethos of, you know, just a type of whimsical. We're certainly kind of throwing back, you know, a lot of people are like, oh, it reminds me of my experience watching Goonies or something, you know? And somebody the other day said, Wing Feather reminds me of Winnie the Pooh. I said, that was such a fascinating comparison. And it's for how it makes you feel.
Right.
And the tissue of these things. And I think that's what we're going to be leaning into. Certainly Wing Feather is redemptive at its core. I think that I've had a great pleasure in my career of being a part of a number of different storytelling that is rooted in redemptive stories, sometimes more overt Bible stories with VeggieTales, but a lot of our VeggieTales were just great stories. Like, we were telling just kind of classic stories, but rooted in redemptive arcs, right? That says this has deeper meaning that you can go decide yourself. I think the thing we love about our stories is that we want them to, in the C.S. Lewis vernacular, awaken that sense of deep longing that we have for deeper meaning in the world.
Right.
And whatever that is for your family, for you as a person watching, whatever spiritual background or non-spiritual background you come from, that it provides deeper meaning and conversations to spew out of. Awesome. That's the kind of story we want to be involved in.
Very cool.
And we have lots of great stories that we know we'd love to help champion and bring to life as we move on from Wing Feather.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, we will wrap this up, but I did want to, we have a little special thing for this episode. You got the book?
I do.
All right.
Check it out.
So this is The Art of the Wing Feather Saga. And I know Garrett Taylor, who we mentioned here, is a longtime Pixar artist, 11 years. And then Nicholas Cole, who's a fantastic illustrator, have their hands all over this book. And it's a wonderfully well done book. And we're going to be giving away some copies in this one. So when you retweet, post on your social media with a certain hashtag, and I'll put this in the show, we're going to give away a couple books within the U.S. I think we got to keep it to the U.S. because I think shipping
international gets a little bumpy. Yeah.
Way costly. So we're going to give away some books on this one here. Special deal for this
one. Yeah, this Art of Season 1 is just an amazing, it tells the story of the creation of Season 1, both from a, how did we make the animated series? Like, how did we get energy from an audience? How did we get financed? Like, that's kind of in part of the story, as well as artistically, how did we break through and make the story? And the chapter kind of unfolds with both an episode and how that episode was a catalyst for us solving a new artistic challenge, overcoming it and getting to the end result. So I think it's immensely valuable. Like, as a reader, like, I love being able to read what others' journeys were through their artistic process. And so it's not just a book of art, which it could be, but it's also meant to inspire and say, hey, here was our journey through. Maybe that's useful for you and whatever you're creating to read and go do likewise.
Right.
And one of the things I failed to mention, Larry, is the influence of art books on what we made here. And while at DreamWorks, we would get the Art of books for all the wonderful movies. And so many times we would look at the art in those books and go, man, wouldn't it be cool if that image was on a 40-foot screen instead of being rendered through the computer?
Right.
And that became the, could we? could we just put that painting, concept painting, on the screen? Like, what would the audience do? I don't know. Let's find out. So Wing Feather was born out of that. Like, literally take the art book and just... So then you're like, why did you make an art book? Because you already showed it. Well, get all the character stuff off, Larry. Get all those fun animators out of the way so I can see my art. And display some of this beautiful artwork in its kind of cleanest form, you know.
One of the things that's great, too, that you bring that up is if you look at the models, and I know one of our favorites, Juan Solis, he's done some of our iAnimate models. But he was so true to Nicholas Cole's illustrations.
Yeah,
so you get that same feel when it's animated, rendered out in the looks that we have, and it feels like it is an illustration. So that's one of the reasons why I love this so much. So
yeah. Juan Solis, man, that guy, jeez.
Phenomenal artist. All right. Well, Chris, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. I'm looking forward to getting this episode out and definitely get that word out, and we'll give some books away. So thank you very much. And with this, we are out.
Thank you.